This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Well, Italian police have arrested 13 people who are involved allegedly in a major international people smuggling network, and they are accused of trafficking hundreds of people, not just through Italy, but across Europe.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna. We'll have full details coming up.
Also, the African Union welcomes Morocco as a member.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the African Union has welcomed Morocco into the continental body, but the transition may not be a smooth one, as the central argument that provoked Morocco to quit the Organization of African Unity in 1984 has yet to be resolved. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Addis Ababa.
African leaders say, in the end, the decision to allow Morocco back into the African Union was a choice between unity and harmony. Unity won at this year's summit, when 39 of 54 AU members supported the move to welcome back Morocco after it quit in 1984 because the AU recognized the independence of the disputed Western Sahara territory. Morocco continues to claim Western Sahara, and Western Sahara remains an AU member. Their dispute remains unsettled. Egypt's Assistant Foreign Minister for African Affairs, Mohamed Idris.
The general conviction within the Union, and this was Egypt's position as well, that at the end we have to have the African house together. So it is important to find a way forward, not a divisive way forward, but to move forward on a common African interest, common African spirit. So we like many other sister African countries, welcomed the comeback of Morocco, and we look forward that this comeback would be a step forward to find a smooth navigation on these problematic issues which have been lingering for quite some time.
Western Sahara's delegation disagrees and accuses Morocco of colonizing the large seaside territory. Ambassador-at-Large Sidi Omar says allowing Morocco to enter without settling the Western Sahara dispute violates the AU's strong stance against colonialism. The delegation wants a clear commitment from Morocco that it will abandon its claim to the territory.
It does not only concern Western Sahara or the Sahara Republic. It does concern Africa as a whole. If this principle of borders is not respected, Africa will be doomed to chaos and back to Asia's, where we're rife, fraught with conflict.
But delegates and diplomats told VOA on the summit sidelines, there may be something to the idea that Africa needs to stick together. A number of summit delegates publicly, and more forcefully privately, aired concerns about recent sudden changes in U.S. policies, not just on immigration, but also on foreign relations and climate change. Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Environment, Judy Wakungu, told VOA that conversations at this AU summit about sticking to the Paris Agreement on climate change were overshadowed by the arrival of the new U.S. administration.
It affects all of us. The largest committers, of course, are the United States, China. Those are the largest committers. So we're seeing on the one hand that China is trying to reduce its carbon footprint, that China is committing to its nationally determined contribution, showing leadership in solar energy commitments, for example. But then on the other hand, we're then seeing pronunciations that the new U.S. administration is going to actually roll back on the commitments that have been made. As I've said, it's only January, and we hope that reason will prevail because we're all in the same boat.
African unity was the original goal of the AU's precursor organization, and it appears that today's AU is trying to get ever closer to it. But in an ever more complicated world. Anita Powell, VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Italian authorities have broken up a human trafficking ring that spread from Italy throughout countries in Europe. A total of 34 warrants were issued to traffickers of various nationalities. Authorities say they had been investigating the case for 2 years. Hundreds of migrants were being transported out of Italy to other European countries in horrific conditions. Reporter Josephine McKenna spoke with me about the trafficking ring, as well as the EU's latest statement released today regarding those seeking asylum.
Well, Italian police have arrested 13 people who are involved allegedly in a major international people smuggling network, and they are accused of trafficking hundreds of people, not just through Italy, but across Europe. And this organization consisted of Egyptians, North Africans, Sudanese, Albanians, as well as some Italian citizens too. And the migrants came from Syria, Egypt, Eritrea, and Sudan. And when they made their way across Italy, usually by boat, to the Sicilian port of Catania, they would transfer to Milan, where the network had its major base. And after reaching Milan, the migrants were then transferred to Ventimiglia, the town which is right on the border of France and has seen a huge number of migrant arrivals in the last couple of years. There they were gathered together and hidden while they were awaiting transport into France and Austria.
How were they actually transported?
Well, the chief investigator, her name is Ilda Boccassini. She's a state prosecutor in Milan. And she told the media that up to 40 migrants had paid up to 1,000 euros, so around 1,000 US dollars. And they were packed like meat, she said, into trucks. Most of the trips abroad took place at night. So the migrants were crammed into the back of cars and into wooden crates inside vans in really dehumanizing conditions. And she described this network as a globalization of evil. And she said it was simply just a drop in the ocean, not really reflecting the full extent of international human trafficking and what is going on.
I understand Italian authorities had been working on this case for about 2 years.
Yes, the Italian authorities issued 34 arrest warrants after this two-year investigation. 18 involve people based in Italy, but it seems that there are others also in other countries. The investigations were coordinated by the anti-mafia police in Italy, which deals with organized crime and other crimes as well. So this is really quite a breakthrough for the police, but as the prosecutor herself said, it's really just a small victory in what is considered to be an enormous human trafficking industry that's involved in moving people, particularly across North Africa, through Libya, across the Mediterranean, into Italy and into other countries.
Also today, the EU court says that asylum can be denied to those migrants who have links with terrorist organizations. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
We had a significant decision today from Europe's top court, the European Court of Justice, saying that political asylum can be rejected for an applicant seeking protection if that person is found to have links to a terrorist organization. And that is a big decision. This case concerns Moroccan national Mustafa Lounani, who was jailed for 6 years for helping to make forged documents for jihadists heading to Iraq. Now, he applied for refugee status because he feared persecution if he was sent back to Morocco. But the court said if someone does not commit or support terrorist acts, asylum can still be denied for helping to recruit or organize or equip foreign fighters. And that could be significant for countries or authorities who are trying to protect various countries from what they consider to be alleged terrorists who may simply be migrants seeking political asylum, but who are found to have links with terrorist organizations.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
Z Zimbabwe's national railway system has been facing challenges and failing to earn profits, due in part by failing to adapt to changing technology. Rail travel was popular in the early 90s and also 10 years later during economic decline. Kudzanavashi recently rode the train in to assess the country's rail service.
It's 12 midnight at Harare train station, and the railway announcer finally announces the train set to take passengers that have been waiting for it for hours without any explanation. This is one example of how the National Railway Service has declined over the years. A boarding passenger, Samson Ndebele, says the National Railways of Zimbabwe, also known as NRZ, has become unreliable.
The current service by the NRZ is quite disappointing, especially when it comes to timekeeping, because they are not very reliable during what they say, especially if you notice about the train trip yesterday's. We were supposed to depart Harare at 8 o'clock, but only to depart at 12 p.m. And the time that we got to Bulawayo was actually at about 4 o'clock.
In the past, the National Railways of Zimbabwe played a crucial part in the development of the country. The president of Confederation of Zimbabwe Industries and CEO of United Refineries Limited, Busi Samuel, explains.
The National Railways of Zimbabwe has a very critical role. It is still a critical component because no country can industrialize without an effective railroad system. You need railroads to access markets within the country, to access your ports, and you need a low-cost road. Is another high-cost problem that we have using road transport. You're meant to use rail because rail allows you to move cargo at a fraction.
The train's affordability and reliability made it popular with the economically hard-pressed citizens. The popularity has faded over the years, though Ndebele explains why it is still his preferred way to travel.
It is something that I have grown fond of. For me personally, I use the train because it is a safer way to travel other than road, because on road you experience many accidents, especially during the season that we have passed through.
Ndebele explains other people that choose the train as their mode of transport.
The train is used by people of different ages. As you saw, the others were actually old. The pensioners in there, and there were even school children who are now going back to their respective homes from their extended families. For school now, coming from school holidays, since schools are now opening.
The majority in the train travel in large groups and cut back on the extra money they would have used on the road. The uncertainty of arrival and departure time often forces people to spend on food. As hectic as this sounds, it has provided an opportunity for some. Ndebele explains.
Even other people take it as an opportunity not only to travel but to do business. As you saw, that there were even others who were vending different things, from fruits, biscuits, even drinks.
Despite affordability, many say the competition will see road winning over rail. Ndebele agrees.
It is quite cheaper, but only by a few dollars. But considering the time that it takes, most people opt for road, because the train doesn't really have a specific timetable.
Ndebele wishes some of the problems are solved soon.
We wish that the NRZ would correct what they say is wrong, because they always talk that it's their issues of communicating between other trains that will also be on the road. So we just hope that they will correct that and it will be useful to us as train lovers.
The National Railways has not changed its wagons since the 80s when Zimbabwe gained its independence. Some critics argue that the monopoly they have and still enjoy has made it nearly impossible to the National Railway to innovate and move with the times. Over the decades, the railway has made its catchphrase, "We move the nation," a redundant one. Like many companies in Zimbabwe, the train company has often made headlines for its increasing debt and its failure to pay its employees. The Public Relations Office of the National Railways did not respond to requests for comment. This is Kudzai Zinawashe reporting for Voice of America from Harare.
Egypt has borrowed $12 billion from the International Monetary Fund to help curb its growing economic crisis. As part of the agreement, Cairo agreed to modify its economic program, including curbing fuel subsidies, increasing the cost of government services, and devaluing the country's currency. Average Egyptians complain that the reforms have led to higher food prices and other inflation. Dr. Mohamed Fanish is a former executive director for the Middle East at the IMF. He spoke with Mohamed El-Shenawi about the Egyptian government's handling of the financial problem.
Basically, the fund role is to provide financing relatively at a relatively lower cost. They have to reduce the budget deficit, raise the interest rate, do something about the subsidies, energy and other subsidies, some structural reforms, do something about the foreign exchange market. These are the objectives. This, of course, in the short run will raise the rate of inflation, which is about 13 now or 14. To reduce public spending also will add to the inflationary pressure. But at least this is in the short run. But the answer of the fund and the Egyptian to that we will do something about the poor, the social network. Some of the money which will be saved as a result of these measures will be spent on the poor, whether in form of direct subsidies, food subsidies, or direct transfers, school lunch, medical expenses. This will be basically allocated to the poor. But no matter what, in the short run, there is a problem. And that's why most of the governments are afraid of taking these measures. It seems this time they're serious for reasons, I think. Some of the measures have been already taken place. For example, on the energy, reducing public spending, they already took place.
Judging from experience of troubled economies and countries with deep debts, what should Egypt do to get out of its economic troubles?
Historically, I can't remember any country made it just because of a fund program or bank program. But the program to be successful, there are conditions. If the program is homegrown, completely owned by the authorities, there is acceptance on the political and on the people's level. So the chances of the program will be much better. And there are other issues. I think in the case of Egypt now, it's not enough to either vote for the program or against the program. The question is, will this program lead, at least in the longer term, to a better economic management, or we will end up with higher costs for the poor and the middle class and more debt for the country in the long run? I think one of the issues now in Egypt, something has to be done about the political situation. For a program to be successful, you need support. So this is one area. There are issues which should be discussed openly. For example, the role of the government and the role of the state. What's the role of the private sector? The tax system. Who will bear the burden? We have to think about that seriously. And the openness. Without reasonable, unified domestic front and security, and political stability, it's very difficult to talk about attracting foreign direct investment or more money, because one of the objectives of the program is to catalyze more support from others, from the capital markets, from bilateral donors, from other international institutions. It's not enough to have the stamp of the fund to attract all these things. So the government has to do other things. And a program should be discussed openly. Explain to the people, why are we doing that? And in the absence of political stability and freedoms, rule of law, and respect of the constitution, it's very difficult to convince the public that just accept this austerity program and things will be better in the future. So we have to be very open about all these issues.
That was former IMF official Dr. Mohamed Fenech. She was speaking with reporter Mohamed Elshenawy.
A national strike has paralyzed Kenya's public health system. The doctors are demanding the government live up to its 2013 agreement to increase their salaries and address other issues like the lack of adequate medical equipment. But the strike has left tens of thousands of Kenyans without access to affordable medical care for almost 2 months. VOA's Jill Craig reports from Nairobi on one artist who is using his creativity to show the impact of the strike on ordinary people.
He starts with a basic idea, then fills the canvas as different thoughts pop into his head. In this case, using his pencil and paintbrush to depict the effects of an ongoing doctor's strike in Kenya.
Let me say I'm just creating awareness. I'm not favoring any side, but I'm just neutral. But I take my art. You know, art is a very powerful tool. I'm taking it as a tool to facilitate to the ongoing strike so that people can know their positions and then they can be able to come together faster and solve the issue.
And so Kenyan artist Joseph Mbatia, better known as Bertiers, has started working on a new piece that depicts his interpretation of the strike, not the first time he's worked on this theme. In 2014, Ebola hit West Africa, and many were concerned it might move east. So Bertiers imagined a doctor's strike coinciding with an Ebola outbreak in Kenya.
I had planned that to do that because I had some rumors that doctors were going to strike. And in fact, they did it.
The strike happened. Ebola did not. And Bertiers showcased this piece at an East African art auction in 2015, one of the many politically and culturally motivated works he has created here at his studio on the outskirts of Nairobi. He says there's a reason for the many sardonic details that characterize his style.
With me, when I draw it like that, it gives more impact to people out there to see that the matter is becoming even more serious. When you go to the hospital and find that there are some dead people in the bed and the others who are coming to see their loved ones, whether they are being given drugs, it is really not too good.
And as he continues to work in his studio, Bertier says he hopes the doctors will soon go back to work as well. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Barty here to remind you that February is Black History Month here in the United States. And starting Wednesday, February 1st, and continuing throughout the month, we will begin our Black History Month and daily quiz series on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African Americans and African individuals and events. Send us your country's historical moment in February. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. We will select a winner each morning from among the correct answers.
Get up, stand up. Stand up. For-